This is Brian Bowler, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 11th of June 2012. Brian Bowler, Part 1.
Well, I was born on the 22nd of April 1932, and I was born in Leicester. And you've got my name, Brian Anthony Bowler, so that's...
So you're now 80 years old, Brian?
Hmm?
You're now 80.
Yeah, that's true. Yes, that's true.
And still working?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I'd be bored stiff. I'm sort of groundsman at a jet ski site. I mow the grass, pick rubbish up, and go for bits and pieces and spares. And I do that during the summer. During the winter, I bug off to France or live with my children. And it's a pleasant life and keeps me busy. God knows what I'd do if I wasn't working. I'd be bored stiff.
We're recording this interview in a rather bijou caravan.
Yeah.
Tell me about this caravan.
Well, I was flying gliders in Austria near Zurich, on Zell-Amsee. And a German bloke there said, come for a cup of coffee. And he had one of these. He also had an aeroplane, which I wanted to fly, so I'd been nice to him. And I want one of these. Lovely.
What is it?
It's an Ereba Puck. It weighs 380 kilos, and that's all. It was built just after the Second World War. They started making them. The guy was an aerodynamics expert. And as you can see, it's big enough for two people to sleep in, two people to stand up in, and you can tow it behind 1,000cc. And I've had several people, in fact, one the other day, a bloke with a brand new BMW 4x4 said, I want it. I said, no, it's not for sale. He said, well, if it... I said, no, I'm going to give my daughter it, because she likes it. She's very much caravanning and camping inclined. And he said, well, I want second refusal then. And that guy, I mean, you look them on eBay. Not eBay, look them on the internet. 40, 45 years old, £2,500, which is... It must be the only caravan in the world that doesn't depreciate.
Yeah.
But as you can see, what's it got? It's got a fridge, it's got a heater, it's got a built-in sink, cooker, elevating roof. You know, what more do you want?
And
really?
Just enough room for one mic stand.
Yes, yeah.
You mentioned the family. You've got quite a young family, Brian.
Yeah, well, I came... first marriage was a bit of a disaster, really. And I came back, and I met a Scottish girl. We got married, and we had a young boy, and he was about 4 and a half when he died from meningitis. And that put me back a bit of a shock. And during the process and getting, I got over that for a bit, and I met this other young girl, and no intentions of making a partnership or something, but we ended up in partners, and we had three children together. But as is someone like me, you could never keep a relationship going for very long.
How young is the youngest child?
At the moment she's 12, coming 13 sort of in a few weeks' time.
Tell me about your parents, Brian.
Well, my mother came from York. My father was a soldier, and he met her in York, and I think he nicked her off several other blokes, because she was very, very well educated, and he was just a grafter. He was a rough rider in the cavalry, and they got a job in he got a job in Melton Mowbray with the veterinary corps, as it is now. And so we ended up there. He then worked for a transport company, the bus company Barton. And bless him, he ended up in the office running the bloody show. And then they had a major fallout with the management, some unknown reason. It's the only time I've ever heard him swear, when he called a manager a bloody fool. I mean, that's the only swear word he'd ever used. And he went to work at a woodyard as traffic manager there. And I was in the army at the time, and I used to come home and labour in the woodyard to keep fit, throwing doors about and generally keeping fit and out of trouble, which is quite difficult for a young soldier.
Did he join the army straight from school?
No, I did a bit of work. I worked as a radio operator type announcer in Northampton in the old days on Radio Relay. and we used to make programmes up from Hilversum and Luxembourg, and I mean, you'll understand what it was like. And we used to wake the town up at 6:30 in the morning, because they were on cable network, but it came off at 6:30 and woke everybody up. I overslept one morning in Northampton, slept over. But no, I enjoyed that, but I'd always wanted to join the army. My father was an army man, and I don't know, I wanted to do it, and I gave it a go, joined the army on a reasonably short stay. Got promoted very quickly and demoted even quicker. I was up and down like a yo-yo for several years. I don't know, I enjoyed it. But, I ended up being a radio instructor and a driving instructor and all that sort of crap. And then a bloke I knew, a captain I'd known and got out of trouble, to put it politely, came in one day and said, "Oh, I've got a unit for you. Come and have a look at this." I said, "Well, it's a special patrol unit that is starting up." So I went down to the special patrol unit and they accepted me. And after a lot of training and PE and that sort of thing, it was basically SAS without the guns. And there were only 18 of us. And they taught us to ski and read Morse, and we played badminton and threw logs about, and we started PE first thing in the morning for breakfast, and we had PE last thing at night before we went to bed. And basically we were 100% fit. I don't think, you know, anybody less a professional, the only people who were probably fitter would be professional sportsmen. That folded, and I went back to my regiment, applied to join the Army Air Corps, passed the aircrew selection board, and went flying. That only lasted because, I mean, I wasn't a brilliant pilot, but they only wanted 4, and they put 12 on, and I was number 6 to go. And came back to you, go anywhere you want. I said, "Well, you know, I'll go back to my regiment because I know everybody there. And once you've been in the army, it's a sort of a home for you, if you know what I mean." So I got back to my regiment, and I was in the office one day. I was a sergeant doing something. And this bloke that sort of a job in a special patrol unit and been promoted came in and said, "Have you read?" I said, "No." "So what's it?" He said, "Well, there's a firm called FIDS. One of their drivers has dropped dead, and they want to know if we can lend them one." I said, "So?" He said, "Well, they want someone who can drive a tank and ski." Oops. So I was sort of volunteered, you know. And I went to Cambridge to see Sir Vivian Fuchs, and we had a very pleasant interview. About we talked about no snow whatsoever, and the only thing I said, "Well, what books can I read on how they drive muskegs and look after tractors in the snow?" And he sort of said, "Well," he didn't say much, the gal that he wanted me to write it. I mean, everybody knew all about it, but I don't think anybody put it down on paper. So I got thrown in at the deep end.
What year was this, Brian?
It was 60, if I remember rightly.
So, did you know where the Antarctic was, roughly?
Yes, I mean, I wasn't totally uneducated, and there's the top bit's the Arctic, and the bottom's the other one. And I'd lived in Germany for about 5-6 years. And I travelled to Austria, Norway, Denmark, Holland, with the forces all the time. I didn't go to Ireland until later, and that was before the trouble. It was a nice place then. And So I sort of volunteered, you know, and it was one year driving snowcats.
I suppose what I meant was, how much did you know about the Antarctic? Had you read
Napple?
You hadn't read about Scott and Shackleton?
I didn't like Scott.
You didn't like him?
No. I thought he was a bit berk. You know, when you select your doctor on the premise that he can draw pretty pictures but knows Napple about scurvy, you're not the brightest of people. You may be very determined and very brave, but I don't admire brave people unless they've got a bit of brain to go with it. Mm. I mean, the bravest people in my mind are these bomb disposal guys.
Yeah.
Very educated, done a 7-year course, and still know if they put the thing in wrong, it's a bloody great bang, and that's the end of their career. So people who make cock-ups like Scott did, I'm sorry. You know, I mean, OK. Now, Shackleton, totally different. My hero. You couldn't wish for a better guy.
So you knew about him before you went south?
Yeah, well, I'm a fairly avid reader, but I wasn't particularly bothered about it. In fact, I wasn't really bothered about any apart from my army career and flying sailplanes. That's all. I mean, I spent every weekend flying. I ended up an assistant CAT instructor, and I was in charge of the ground equipment, an RAF base. That's the winches and the cars and the cable retrieve vehicles. And I'd spend all day driving the winch. Oh, it looks nice. I'd go down, jump in an aeroplane, go flying for an hour or two, then come back and get back on the winch. Because I'm a solitary person, as you probably gather. And I enjoyed it. I had great fun. I was in RAF Bruggen. And I did the first 5 hours that was ever done there. And I'm very proud of myself because I landed. Immediately another four came down because it's a brilliant day. You couldn't get down, so I wasn't really no claim to fame at all. And I was the first guy to get down.
Get down.
To land at Bruggen. I spent 5 hours flying.
Where's Bruggen?
It's on the border between Holland and Germany, RAF Bruggen. It's one of the biggest air bases in the world. Near Rheindahlen, you've probably heard of Rheindahlen. Yeah. Quite close to there. And that was when I was with the Special Patrol Unit down in Krefeld. So, yeah, I just kicked around. I'd been to Norway for 6 weeks. So the British Army sent 50 skiers to Norway to have a battle with the Norwegians, and we beat them absolutely hollow. We didn't go out on the skis. We took the flu with us and nearly killed the poor sods. Half of Norway went down with the flu that we brought, you know.
So did you actually join FIDS as such? Were you transferred to FIDS or did you...
No. Ooh, but,
go on.
I was seconded by the army under detachment, and as such, would they mind paying my wages? And they sort of said yes. We'll accept that because it's urgent. And the bloke said, well, as it's urgent and he's got hard conditions and not, you know, we'd like a little bit more. So then I said, well, yes, we can do that. I said, but the other thing is no discipline, you see. So he's got to have a good behaviour bonus. And I felt that, no, I didn't. So I felt guilty. I mean, I was earning sort of so much more than the poor old fidger on £10 a week and suffering like mad. But you know, so what? It was there. I wasn't going to turn it down, you know. Thank you very much. So I was paying UK tax anyway.
Right.
I know. I came back and walked into the car showroom and bought a brand new car for cash.
How did you get down there?
I went on the Kista. I had a very tremendously good trip on the Kista. I got on with the captain and the first mate very, very well indeed. The Kista down, and I was absolutely gobsmacked how well they spoke English. In fact, one of them was keen on cameras, and we were talking. He was a Danish bloke talking about spherical aberration. The average Englishman doesn't know what it means. And I also knew enough about Denmark, because I'd been there, when they said, we're crossing the equator, you can have any meal you like. And somebody said, I like roast beef and Yorkshire pudding. And I went, well, I know what the Danes can do with Yorkshire pudding, so I opted for sort of mortgage bread. And the Yorkshire pudding arrived rather like a lump of belly outside of a dead cow, you know. No, they were great. And I got to Montevideo, and we had a couple of days there, and everyone was on strike. And it was my introduction to meat there. I mean, it was the first time I'd ever had a decent steak in my life. And as I say to people, they take the legs off and put it on a plate. You know, it's an enormous, great steak. And I enjoyed that. Then I went to Stanley, and I met John Green was there. And he had the brilliant idea of unload the Muscade and show the islanders what they could do cross-country. So they dumped a muskeg on the quayside, and I drove it round the camp for a bit, and all the farmers came and looked at it and wondered. And I thought later on, when the Falklands War was over, you great twats, if you'd only kept helicopters, you could have taken a load of muskegs down there and done the job at damn sight more efficiently. But, you know, you don't tell the general that. You can't tell the general that.
Had you seen a muskeg before?
Nope. No, I hadn't. So what was I lived with tanks. I was a tank man, you see, originally.
So what was your learning curve like for a muskeg?
Backwards. You know, I'm used to sort of 650 brake horse and 50 tons. So you give me something weighing, 5,000 kilos and 100 brake horse side valve engine. Whoops.
They were toys, were they?
No, they were serious, very, very strong, brilliant bits of kit. I mean, if I remember right, well, I don't remember rightly, I've only just heard about it, but I gather one of them we got down to the bluff lasted 30 years. I don't know, do you know if that's true or not?
I've got a feeling it's still there.
Well, he's not running, though.
I don't know.
No, I was reading somewhere that it was still running after 30 years. Now, that is not a delicate piece of modern equipment. It's a tough old industrial bit of, you know. I dropped one from about 6 foot. Because, you know, when you're driving through pressurised, you know, it's a bit sort of lumpy. And I came over the top and it dropped on the... It didn't even drop straight. It dropped on the corner of the front where the drive sprocket was. And it... With a horrible boom, thump, you know? And then I'd drive off. I mean, I've done that with a tank, smashed the front bearing, the idler bearing. I did the death slide at Bobbington with a Centurion. I did both front bearings in, but someone had forgotten to bulldoze the ground and make it soft. So, 50 ton doing 30 foot drop on a rock isn't a good thing.
But the muskegs, you were pleased with their performance, were you?
Oh, I thought they were brilliant. There was a lot wrong with them, but not mechanically, really. One of the problems was, so simple, it was the doors. They didn't fit. Well, you know what the drift's like.
Yeah.
You sort of go in the morning and your cab would be full of snow. So that was one problem. The other problem, and I don't know how we cured it, was... To be honest, it saved our lives. The snow was picked up on the by the tracks, obviously. And if the wind was in the wrong direction, the radiator fan picked it up. And it clogged up the radiators, and they overheated. And we were running back from the first depot to Stonington when that happened. And basically, it was a case of the weather looks bloody awful. We're not going to make it with this heating problem. We'll stop on the sea ice, bit on the east side of this island, and wait till the weather clears and get on with it. And the weather got bad and worse, and it blew, and there was a bang on the tent, and Howard Chapman came up and said to stick your head out and have a look at this. And there was more sea on there than a bloody picture postcard from Skegness, and before it had all been ice and it had buggered off. So we went panic. We'd moved round to, we're now moved round the island overnight, and I wouldn't swear blind to it, but I would say between 50 and 100 metres, the Bellingshausen had come. All the other ice having had gone. Nennyfield had gone, the bloody lot had gone out to sea. And we missed it by 100 yards. You know. We'd have been camped on it if the engine had been running properly. So we panicked. Well, we didn't panic. We just got on with it and got on the island and sent a Mayday. Mayday, I love that. Mayday, Mayday, Mayday. I'd always wanted to send one. You know. And John Cunningham's... John Cunningham said, no, who was the base? It was John Cunningham, wasn't it? John Cunningham said, oh, don't worry, everything's all right. We'll go up and have a look at the sea ice from the top of the highest hill or something. And then came back and said, don't panic. And I go, they told London about it. And London sent a message saying, remember, Shackleton built a boat. Shackleton had a ship in his boat, but never mind. And Fortunately, although it was fairly late on the year, it froze. Dog team came out from Stonington with a few bits and pieces, and the other dog team came back from further down. And we got on with it and went down south. And very nearly reached the King George Sound when I made a bad decision. But when you're driving and it's all those conditions, you're making 100 decisions or 1,000 decisions a day, and you get 990 right, and you get one wrong, the bloody thing goes through and sinks, which is a bit embarrassing.
So this is another occasion when you were actually on the Muskeg, and it went.
Yeah, we went. Yeah, we did. We went from Stonington to Fussell Bluff, and I loaded everything up reasonably. As I say, it was fuel and dog food and man food on every sledge, and we had tent. I think we had two tents or one tent, and that was way back on the train. So that if anything happened and we lost both muskegs, then we'd still got a sledge and sort of lifeboat equipment. And when we ran back, as I was coming back when the sea ice blew out, we were carrying, I think we were carrying about 4 weeks lifeboat rations for us. And so we went on to half rations on HF6, you know that lifeboat stuff. It tastes awful. Well, it's supposed to, but I mean, you don't enjoy a meal on a lifeboat, do you? And I lost a considerable amount of weight. I think we all did on the quiet. But we got away with it. We were very lucky. I gather that previously the Argentinians had these weasels that floated, and they lost some guys because once they go in the water, they can't get out. So the weight of the tractor on the edge of the ice, it'll spread out, it'll survive, but when it's climbing out, he puts all the weight on the ice, and he just can't get out with the damn things. And so they.
So just take me through those two incidents in more detail, if you wouldn't mind. The first one was when you were driving along the tractor, and the water started coming up through the floor. Is that right?
No, I drive along the tractor, and I'm leading with the rope about still slack, and I make a decision to go for this slight rise in the sea ice, and it went, boom, just dropped. I went, oops. And I looked out, and I said I could get out because I always drove with the doors open on sea ice. I looked out, and it was getting a bit wet, the snow. So I yelled for we yelled and got another tractor on, and I climbed back in and tried to drive it out backwards. And you don't really stand much of a chance, you know. And I think the reason we lasted that long was because we'd put planks on outriggers. Whoops, sorry, man. We put planks on outriggers for crossing cracks and that sort of thing. And I think as we dropped through the water, the outriggers hit and held a minute and gave me time to get out. And I got out, and Howard Chapman took the photograph of a hole with a bit of wood floating in it. That wasn't one of my best days for them. You know.
Were the two muskegs roped together?
Yeah.
So how come the second one didn't go in?
Oh, it was a long rope and we cut it.
Right.
No, we had about 100 foot.
There was no chance of getting this muskeg back?
The Americans have got them. A submarine can go to several thousand feet, but I don't know. I mean, it was deep water, it was the sea. Yeah. We hadn't got onto the sound, you know. I gather the sound has meltwater now, but this was hogging, proper sea, you know.
Yeah.
It was just a...
One of those things.
I say, you make 100,000 decisions, 1,000 decisions a day, and you get one wrong. You can't go ahead checking it all the time, you know. There's no way around this ice road trucker thing. They've got radar now that can tell you how thick the ice is, you know. And I have a feeling if we'd known how thick the ice is, we'd never have been there. It's just as well we didn't know.
And you also had applied a policy of spreading the supplies out among several, grouping it so that what if anything went under, what was left will keep you going for a while.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I would seem daft to do anything else, really. And then, of course, when we parked up at night, we used to spread the stuff out. I mean, if you looked at it, it looked as though it was scattered. But you've got to do that because if you stick things in a line, the snow will then melt, will concrete everything in and got one complete block. So you spread everything out. Again, if you have a disaster like as we had with the sea ice blowing up, at least if you've got one sledge, you've got food and that sort of thing, you could survive for a bit until you either stop surviving or somebody came to get you.
On this trip, where you were stranded on an ice floe for a while, which you were talking about a few minutes ago, was this up near Mushroom Island? Was this?
No, I don't think it was Mushroom. I think it was one up from Mushroom. Mushroom was, I think, was a depot. I'm not sure. There aren't many maps of the area, and we didn't have maps anyway. You could sort of, hey, up out of Nennyfield, turn left and go south, young man. Yeah. And when you see the mountains on both sides, that's the field. Go down there and you'll find Fossil Bluff on the right, you know. I still don't know how far it was. I have no idea. I just put enough fuel on that if the tractors used more than 1 gallon per mile, we were in trouble, but I didn't think they would. And so I stuck sort of three drums on each of the sledges and lashed them on with chains and realised that, you know, when you're going through really rough sea ice and pressure ice, and your sledges sort of tend to tip over, so you don't just pile stuff on, you have to lash it down good and proper. But that was a series. I've been in Norway with a Pult. That's the Norwegian sledge that you tow behind you like a pram in reverse, and that's totally waterproofed and everything's carried inside there, so it seemed logical to do it that way.
But this was a trip you were taking down to Fossil Bluff, wasn't it?
Yeah.
When you became stranded on the sea ice for a while.
Well, yeah, that was the first year.
Yeah, in 1960. 60. Okay. And there were four of you on that expedition.
Yeah.
Yourself, Howard Chapman, Bob Metcalf and Arthur Fraser.
Yeah.
Okay. And just talk me through in more detail what happened. You camped the night on sea ice.
Well, we always camped on sea ice. We had two-man tents and we stopped on sea ice. We ran down to probably Mushroom.
Mushroom Island, yeah.
And we made a depot there.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, the original plan was to go back and fetch another load, just take the weight off the aircraft flying fuel in. I wanted to take some more fuel down.
I think this would be the spring of 61, would it, having arrived in 1960?
Yes, yeah. That's when we built the base. We built Stonington in 60. Yeah. John Cunningham was brilliant. Base leader doing that.
We'll come back to that shortly, if you may.
Yeah.
So here you are, heading south for Fossil Bluff, with two muskegs and a couple of sledges.
No, we had about five, I think.
Five sledges.
I mean, like, we had quite a lot, quite a few.
And the progress wasn't very good, I gather?
No, Well, as you know, the weather is slightly changeable. I mean, it can be pleasant for 10 minutes or an hour or so. The next time it becomes a howling blizzard and you can't see a damn thing. That then stops. And the overcast and the whiteout, you can't see where the hell you're going or what you're driving into. So we tried driving at night on lights, which worked on a compass, just to stop us going out to Bellingshausen too much. And that didn't work very well because you couldn't see too far ahead. I don't know of any better way of doing it. Whiteout's atrocious. I mean, I wouldn't believe what it was like. Second year, we're going down, we're fairly heavily loaded, and it's in whiteout. And the engines weren't pulling properly. My engine certainly wasn't pulling properly. So I've no idea why this is. Everything's all right. So we'll stop. And we stopped and went in the caboose and had a cup of coffee and slept and woke up in the morning and halfway up a bloody iceberg. We'd been climbing. That's why the engines weren't pulling. You know, and we thought, whoops, what are we doing up here? You know. And we went back down, and that was a weird effect because the iceberg was in a field of icebergs, like a city, if you can imagine, roads between it. And that was the first time the sound of the engines had come back, echoing back. It was an eerie experience, rather like driving down a you know these sort of futuristic films after the atomic blip, you know. Just like driving through a city, big wide streets, which were frozen leads, and then the sound coming back was really eerie. It was really strange. Because, you know, out there it's so silent you can hear a dog owling its head off about 5 miles away. You know. Then you know, we'll say whiteout is one of the biggest problems. I don't know. I don't think there's any way of defeating other than probably a very accurate compass and very good lights, and then you could drive at night. But who the hell wants to go and see ice anyway? when you've got aeroplanes and helicopters, it's it's the old-fashioned way of doing it.
The muskegs were generally speaking in tandem, weren't they? One behind the other.
Yeah, I tried to keep them like that.
How was that?
Safety. I mean, I'd been up with John Green on an island. I don't know which island it was. Adelaide, probably. I have no idea. On the way down, and we went for a jolly. And we were just driving there, suddenly enjoying myself and that, and John Green enjoying himself, and then bloody great whoomp! And we climbed out, more or less, and turned around, and bloody great crevasse, you could have put a double deck of us down. We'd missed it, thank God. It didn't strike me at the time as how dangerous life was. But I decided, I'd heard that the Transantarctic Survey guys had given a muskeg to the New Zealanders or the Australians, and that had fallen down a crevasse having crossed Antarctic and killed the driver, been squashed or whatever. So I thought, well, if we rope them together in twos, if the first one goes down, it's going to carry on going down. But if the rope's long enough, it'll cut in and the guy behind will break, and it won't squash the guy because they didn't have roll bars or anything. I mean, now I would not drive anything cross country in the Antarctic without a roll bar, you know, that wouldn't squash. But I'm not going to do that when I'm 80, if you don't mind. it wasn't a design fault, because they were designed to run on the muskeg in Canada, which is basically a load of gorse bushes and heather and not a lot else, but no deep holes they can fall down.
Were you part of the plan to put holes in the roofs of these muskegs?
Oh, yeah, I did that first year, yeah.
That was you, was it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm a tank man. You know, you need escape hatches all over the place, and so you cut a hole in the roof and put a canvas bag on and tied it up and made sure the knot was on the inside.
So, okay, let's go back to this trip south in the first year.
Yeah.
With the two muskegs. And this was the occasion when you woke up one morning and it was explained to you that you were actually adrift on an ice floe.
No, we weren't adrift on an ice floe. What had happened was the ice floe was attached to the island. I mean, if we'd been adrift, we'd have been bye-byes, wouldn't we? We sort of pivoted round the island, and the bits 50 yards on had all gone, but we were still touching the island. And it was fairly solid ice. There were leads, and God knows what, because the whole lot had moved round. And, of course, the obvious thing to do was to get on solid ground as quick as you can, you know.
So tell me the process. What did you do first?
Well, we had a... Howard and I had a little discussion, like, let's get this. And we got the ice chisels out and the ice axes out, and we chiselled away through the pressure, if I remember rightly. And we got one tractor on as fast as we could with the tents and that sort of thing, and then we got the fuel on.
Onto the
island, yeah, off the sea, because we'd had enough of that. We didn't want to go on there anymore, as it was. It was not very nice. And then Arthur and Howard sort of helped putting the tents up and that sort of thing. And we were on there for God knows how many weeks. I've no idea. It was quite some considerable time. And they were worried, the experts, the geologists, and were worried. They said, well, it's very late in the year. It doesn't very often freeze. So we're going to be here until either the Chileans come and get us or the Navy sends a helicopter down in the middle of summer, and we've only got a few weeks rations, which is going to be a bit embarrassing. So, fortunately, the weather turned quiet and cold, and the leads froze up. I'd got enough fuel to get back to the depot, and at the depot, we got enough fuel to get down to Possum Low.
Right.
So off we trogged down to the desk. In fact, the dog team came up and said, oh, you're all right, all the leads are frozen. And we went off downtown.
So whilst you were on Mushroom Island, I think it was Mushroom Island, waiting...
Well, yeah, well, I'll take your word for it.
Waiting for something to happen.
Yeah.
On limited rations.
Yeah.
And limited tentage?
No, we had two-man tents. I mean, you get used to that, don't you?
Yeah. And do you know what happened... to your mayday? Did you get a response?
Yeah, John Cunningham heard it and said, don't panic, everything's all right. I'm looking at Nenny Field and the ice is still there, and no problems at all. I'll go and check. He went and checked and went, I don't want to worry you. No, I mean, you know, I think...
Were you worried?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you can class it as being stupid, you know, if you like. I don't think you're going to face that sort of thing because you rely on luck an awful lot. And we knew that, well, we weren't too bad enough. We got a dog team could probably get back to us if the lead froze over at all.
From Stonington, you mean?
So that, no, not from Stonington, from down Mushroom. They were on the way down. We had two dog teams with us as well. Well, yeah, they weren't. They were out ahead. And, no, we weren't. I don't think we panicked at all, honestly.
Arthur seems to think you discussed cannibalism at one point.
Oh, yeah. We probably discussed a lot of things. I don't know if you remember or not, but at one stage, when we were down there, they had a missile crisis. And the Americans were...
Cuban missile crisis.
Yeah. The Americans are threatening to bomb the Russians, and the Russians are threatening to bomb the Americans. And we sat down quite seriously and talked about how long we could survive, which we worked out about 7 years. What would the radiation be like if we came back to civilization? Would there be any? What would be left of the world? And we were all on our own down there. And I wouldn't think we were the only people thinking that way. So, no, I don't think we discussed cannibalism seriously. I mean, well, it wasn't very much on Arthur Fraser anyway.
But then, mercifully, the sea ice did reform.
Oh, yeah.
But then you were hit by a layup, weren't you, at that point?
By what?
You were stuck in a blizzard which lasted for 13 days.
Oh, yeah, well, so what? That happened fairly frequently for a bit, yeah. I mean, the weather can be like that. I mean, it can go... weeks on end with howling gales and that sort of thing, and it says, oh, I'm sorry about that, the sun comes out. It's, you know, that's what you expect. It's the Bellingshausen, which is fairly crazy. It's affected by the Antarctic convergence, which is sort of a belt of rubbish going all the way around the world at the bottom with nothing in the way. I remember seeing a Chilean fishing boat in the middle of it. I mean, we were sort of hang on a bit, half ahead, trying to survive. This Chilean boat comes sliding down with its nets out. I mean, you've got to take your hats off to these guys.
You had your own personal little crisis whilst that blizzard was taking place because you ran out of cigarettes.
No, I ran out of cigarettes after I lost the tractor. I was the only one that smoked, I think, and I had all my cigarettes on the tractor. And I rescued everything I could, like an empty binocular case and me. And the fags went. And I was without cigarettes for about, I don't know how many weeks it was. And I was at Fossil Bluff and an aircraft flew in. And I think it was Bob Bond, I'm not sure, it might have been Ron Lord. Came to the door and was waving a packet of tin of cigarettes at me. And he's pretending to open them, so I can't get it open. And I'm on my knees saying, please, oh, come on, go, you know. And sorry, he was only enjoying. Turn around, I've been filmed. You sod. And I didn't mind, I got my cigarettes going, because I was a heavy smoker in those days.
Had you tried to improvise in the meantime?
Yeah, I tried tea leaves and toilet paper, and it didn't work. Like nothing. I don't think I got mentally affected by it. It was just... As you know, once you get the nicotine, it gets into you, and it's enjoyable. I loved it. I mean, I was a serviceman, tax-free cigarettes. They used to give us cigarettes. I didn't know they were harmful. I mean, when I was skiing, I trained on Rothmans and gin. You know, I did fairly well. You know, I was third in the division. It was about 10,000 men.
Arthur also mentions an occasion when you began to feel unwell in this tent. Headaches.
Well, I've suffered from sinus trouble all my life, but I can't really remember that. It wasn't a major thing. It could be right, yeah.
You know. The snow almost buried our tent. It had melted next to the tent surface, and when that froze, we were effectively in a sealed space, progressively starved.
Yes, air. That's true. We had a bung in the air vent, and if the candles went out, we used to take the bung out and clear it up. That was 9 days, but I think it was a black tent. I can remember that distinctly. That was a bit. I mean, I've always thought that was bad, and then you realise that some of these kidnapped guys spend a year in a cellar. Well, what we went through was nothing.
You had a black tent?
At one stage, yes.
Which was going to absorb heat?
Well, it wasn't really lighting. That was pretty bloody miserable, considering the amount of time you spent in it during the day. It was just a continuous night, you know.
Was this a pyramid tent or a
thing? Yeah, it's a two-man tent, yeah.
All right.
They had some brilliant ideas. One was that they sent me some black rope down.
Go on.
Lovely. Shows up on the snow, doesn't it?
Yes.
Absorbs the heat, melts into the snow, sun buggers off, melt ice, solid. You've got 200 yards of rope concreted in, you can't get out. And the other thing was, it was polypropylene rope, and so I put it on a track on a sledge, drove off with the sledge, sledge wouldn't move. So I'm still pulling. Sledge comes out and comes howling back like a catapult. This is like a rubber band. Best part of a ton and a half. And sledge comes howling back. Whoops, got that wrong. You know, that was polypropylene rope. And John did the same, actually. He was teaching us how to abseil. John Cunningham. And he was jumping off this cliff. And three times he did it, absolutely perfect, on nylon rope. You know, these guys are these professional climbers, and he sort of came to a rapid halt at the bottom and sort of steps off. And the last one was a terrarine rope, which stretched. He made a hole in the snow. He still was fully composed, but he was a bit cross on himself, I think.
So at one point also, according to Arthur's notes, and again, I'm not quite sure the order of all this, you were actually frozen into your tent at one point, the weight of snow on top of you. You were dug out by Howard and Bob.
Yeah, I honestly can't remember that. But it's quite possible that sort of thing happened anyway. It's not something that sits in your mind. I mean, tenting is... Oh, sorry. Tenting under those conditions is... You're always having disasters, like... somebody once set fire to a... No, they didn't. It's spilt tea on a sleeping bag, which is a crime. Well, next time it happened, he tried to dry it out over the stove and set fire to it, which is another crime. I think that's something that sticks in my mind more than being dug out of a frozen tent, quite honestly.
According to Arthur's notes, you had to blow a whistle to alert people to your predicament.
Yeah, probably. I can't remember any of that at all, quite honestly.
Yeah.
I know I'd had enough of these damp tents and trying to organise things, because tractors are worse to start up than the dog team. At least the dog team wants to go. You know, they get all enthusiastic about things, but the tractor's got to be preheated, and it's so cold that if you get the engine running and you obviously start up with the clutch depressed, and the engine's only just running, you take the clutch off, the gearbox roll is so thick and so heavy it stalls the engine. You've got to... Well, we used to preheat the gearbox. So we had a second year round, we had a Herman Nelson with three leads on it, and we had one lead on an engine, one lead on a gearbox, another lead on an engine, so to start the tractors up. The first one started, then we transferred all two of the other ones to heat the gearbox and engine again. And we could get them running. They would start without preheating down to about minus 10, minus 12. If the forecast was good, was bad, you know, it was going to be cold, we'd pre-dilute the oil, we'd put petrol in the oil and run them for a few minutes to get it all mixed up and give you a chance to start in the morning. I thought that was heresy until I was talking to the aircraft guys, and that's actually on the Beaver engine, where you put a little switch down and it pumps petrol into the oil. And of course, when you start up in the morning, you've got to run them until the vapour comes off, and keep your fingers crossed the flame trap works. I know one in the army, it didn't, it blew the bottom off the engine, but I mean, these things happen.
You're also short of supplies, and you're short of fresh meat in particular, and a group of king penguins strolled by.
Ah, that's when Arthur apologised.
Well, tell me the story, if you wouldn't mind.
Well,
it was clear to tell it.
Well, it's there were just these king penguins on walkabout, and we thought, well, when the dog teams come, we'll have a treat for them, you see, and we'll kill three penguins or four penguins, whatever you want, and we selected them, and they said, well, we'll eat bits, and the dog team can have the rest and cheer them up with a fresh meat, and we selected a penguin. And the funny thing is, penguins are a little bit like, they go up and down. When you look at the big one, turn around, and when you look at it next time, it's gone down. They sort of expand and contract whilst they're standing there. And we all picked our penguins. And as I say, I'd done a lot of skiing, and the best way to kill a penguin is with an ice axe. Well, with the other two rushing around trying to kill penguins with ice axe, my kneecaps were hiding behind my knees, you know. The ice axe is flashing round. Anyway, I'd killed mine, and Arthur couldn't quite get a handle on killing a penguin with an ice axe, and he chased it. And it escaped and went and joined its mates, a bit stupid penguins. He took a swipe at it, missed, and hit the one next to it. Stopped dead in his tracks and bent down and said, "Oh, sorry." And it really was so funny. I mean, he was such a nice guy. He really was. And he was a devout Christian. Both he and Bob Metcalf were, which we respected, you know. And Howard, in his wisdom, said that I would go with one, and the other one would go. We get a Christian each. Which rather ruined the language. So when we got stuck on this island, Howard and I used to go to the top of the island for what was known as the daily swear. So off we went to the top of the island and swore like goodness for 10 minutes.
So you parted company with Arthur after a while. He went in one direction and you went on to Fossil Bluff. How was the rest of that journey down?
No, we all went down to Fossil Bluff.
You all went down, didn't you?
As far as I know, yeah. I mean, I don't think Arthur went up in the dog team. I don't see why he should.
Arthur returned to base to carry out a geological programme, and Brian and the others went down to Fossil Bluff.
Could be. I can't remember it, you know.
Was the rest of the journey fairly uneventful compared?
Apart from losing a tractor, yeah.
And that was when he lost a tractor, was after that, yeah.
So
when you arrived at Fossil Bluff with one tractor too few, what was your reception like?
Well, they were rather pleased. I think the aircraft had been there, actually, but they're still rather pleased to see strange faces. I mean, when you've been on your own for 6 months or so during the winter, even I look attractive, you know. And the same, Howard... Brian Taylor, who was on his own. And I say, I saw him walking down the side of the mountain and saying, "I'm not going to sort of make a big of this," and speeded up his walking and ended up running towards us. And he was very glad to see us. But I don't think he'd been back on base for an aircraft. I think he'd been out on his own knocking bits off Antarctica. I know he brought most of it back. It must be a hole. Must be a big hole in Fossil Bluff where he...
But they'd been there for more than 6 months. They'd been there for quite a long time, hadn't they?
No, I don't think so. They got flown in the autumn. They built the hut and flown in the autumn. Yeah, just over 6 months, and probably 7 months. I don't know. It was something like that. It wouldn't have been absolutely crazy, because the summer season's, what, 5-6 months? I mean, yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, God knows how they survived, just three of them. It was bad enough with 10 of us on the base, then, weren't three? And they got on all right, I gather. Nobody got murdered anybody, really.
Am I right in thinking you made a second trip along
We lost one, and Fidge, in their wisdom, said, we'll try it again. There must have been a brilliant setup of logistics to get another tractor, the charging sets I wanted, the Herman Nelson I wanted, all this stuff I wanted. It all came down on the boat. Absolutely brilliant. I didn't realise it at the time, but I must say that the boat on the Biscay in particular, incredibly helpful. Can I have one of these sort of planks? Have two. Can I have that? No, you see me more current, but I'm going off duty in 10 minutes, and if he's not, then when I come back I don't mind. And anything I wanted I could have. And it was the same on base, the diesel mate. He did an awful lot of work for us. On the boat, first baskets came down deck cargo and got swamped with seawater. And the electricity on the boat, I mean, you couldn't do everything, but we got the starter motors off and the dynamos off, and he boiled them up with distilled water, re-oiled them, and we put them back. Some of the stuff we couldn't get out, the voltage controls we couldn't get into. And they, of course, had ended up sort of a greeny-bluey mush and didn't work very well. I had to replace them with different wattage bulbs than the dynamos in those days. But I say, everybody was so helpful, they really were.
So the second pair of muskegs, then, when they arrived, they weren't working properly because of the seawater problem?
No, that was the first lot.
First lot?
Yeah. Okay, as far as I know, the second lot didn't. So the first lot came down, and we unloaded the ship with them and took Stonington Base in. Over sea ice. I think we started about 15 miles out and ended up about 3 miles out. But the whole of that base was taken in. You've seen the photographs of the big... and we ran that sort of probably 18 hours a day or something like that. We ran fairly busy and got the ship unloaded. But I say they're really very, very good.
Tell me about building the hut then that John Cunningham was in
charge of. It's not a lot I can remember because it was just plain work, but and at the time, I didn't appreciate how good John Cunningham was, because he didn't appear to be organising everything, but he had everything really going nicely. And, of course, poor lad, God bless him, he didn't have a university degree, but he had more brains than your average elephant. You know, he was good gear. I admired him tremendously. He really was. He was good gear. And I went to see him, you know.
Recently?
No, I went. I had a business delivering mobile homes. I had a lorry. And I was owned a driver, and I went up to Aviemore with a caravan. And I heard John Cunningham say, "Yes, he is actually. Yes, he's out at the moment. So I'll give him a regards. Next time I'm here, I'll come and see him." And about a year later, I went up there, Aviemore again, went into the Prince Philip's Trust thing, whatever it was. John Cunningham was dead. Pardon? He's dead. How did he die? It's something about trying to save a girl student in Wales and was drowned. And John Cunningham hated the sort of women climbers and being adventurous. And to sort of end up with that happening to him was really bad luck on John's part, because I thought he'd survive anything. I mean, he did the crossing of Georgia with that... what was his name? I can't remember now. Slightly crazy explorer that spent the year on Georgia. And John did the crossing and took the photographs on that. Duncan Carr, wasn't it? Was it Duncan Carr? Yeah, probably. I don't know. Unfortunate initials, V.D. Carr. I think the reason is just not his qualifications, but I don't know. And I admire John because he was also a very, very good photographer. I mean, he would wait hours for the light to be right, and he would go out and photograph the typical bloody icicle from, you know, and get it perfectly done. Now, have you heard the story about the...
Go on.
The dark room and the paper and that sort of thing?
Please tell.
Haven't you heard it? Ah, well... We had a guy who should be nameless, who was a bit ham-fisted. And if anybody knows about cameras, he broke a Voigtlander. Now, this is the equivalent, the equivalent of bogeying up an anvil, you know. So he said, "Can I go in the dark room tonight, John?" John said, "Yes, but no. Tomorrow." He said, "We've only got one bulb left. Knowing you, it'll bust. Might not be your fault, but it'll bust. Knowing you, you'll leave the paper open. Knowing you, I'll sort it out, you can go tomorrow." So this guy said, "Well, I'll use an ordinary bulb." Okay, fine, fair enough. So next night he goes up and John says, "Now then, I know what you like. Box of papers. You use those and none others, because you'll leave them open. Get on with it. We're downstairs." And John has got a silly grin on his face. And this bloke comes down. "Look at this! What? Look at this!" And he's got a photograph of an iceberg or something. And written across the middle is "Swan, 100 watt, 240 volts. This can't happen. "Well, you know, The guy goes up, gets the ball out, gets emery paper, grinds the name up, puts it back in, puts the paper in, but swan, 100, old ram, you know, 100 watts, 240 volts comes out again. Now we've got, oh, five or six guys with degrees all saying, well, it's a condenser lens, it can't happen. It got there, we did. So anyway, he goes up again. I'll tell you how careless he was. He dropped an unexposed sheet of paper in the developer and it came up 100 watts on the ramp. John had been up and made a negative and exposed all the bits of paper, so when he did it, it all came up. And he was sitting there laughing his head off. Brilliant. Practical joke. I don't think I've ever heard of a better one, you know.
How was it that you did a second year? Because you were only signed up for one, weren't you?
I didn't sign up for anything. I think it was two, it was expected I did two anyway. I wasn't due to come out. And I think if you'd... I've probably been a bit sort of pedantic, but I don't think 1 year is anywhere near enough. I think what you should do is you should do 2 years and then probably have a break of 2 or 3 years and then go back again. Because it's a very specialised, tricky business. And you don't realise just how tricky it is until you... Whether anybody had volunteered to go back is a good time, I don't know. Probably not. No, I think I would have done, actually.
Where did you spend the winter? At Sonnington?
Yeah, oh yeah, it was Donington. So I had the tractors, and I used to feed the dogs sometimes with the tractors when the weather was pretty bad.
Did you put the tractors to sleep for the winter?
Oh yeah, well you've seen the sheets.
Well, tell me how you did that, please.
Well, we had God bless the boat. I had a couple of canvas hatch covers, and we laid them out on the ground with a piece of wood on them, and drove the tractors forward onto the sheets, then threw the sheets all over the tractor and sort of looped ropes around them so they were totally waterproof, so totally snowproof. The doors certainly weren't, you know, and that kept them in good order.
No problem with condensation?
There is no condensation there. It's bone dry. It's so dry that you get ablation. That is snow. Well, you know what an ablation is?
Go on.
Well, ice turns into vapour without going through the water stage. Just, you know, blades. Everything's dry. As I said, I used to smoke. And after about 3 days of having a tin open, you could pick the cigarette up and the tobacco would fall out and you'd end up with a tube of paper. It didn't taste the same. You know.
And they were okay wrapped up for the winter?
Oh, yeah. Yes. And then when I took them out and had a certain amount of work to do on them, what I was going to say was, when the sun came back... It was up on a mountain, which we weren't going to have it for about a fortnight or so. And I ran trips, speedboats around the bay and anymore for the Bluebird, or the Bluebell. And we took the guys up to look at the sun. And we went up the mountain and stayed in the sun for 5 minutes and came back down. So it's still there, you know.
In the Muskeg, you're talking
about? In the Muskeg, yeah. I am sure about 5-6 miles up, something like that.
Let me just change the disc on the machine, if I may, Brian, then we'll talk a bit more.